Hello, this is a short introduction to a couple critical topics in the understanding of reading psychological science and other sciences. The goal of this is that by the end, you'll be able to approach published science with a skeptical eye towards some of the contemporary understandings of methodology in science, particularly to deal with openness and somewhat to deal with pre-registration. You'll also be able to recognize the importance of sample size, representativeness of a sample, the importance of replications, of refereed journals, and of some of the mediocre science that's been done in the recent past, up until somewhere right around 2011. So I want to kick this off by giving you the note that it's starting to seem like, and I'm quite taken by this argument, science may not be the kind of logical problem we have treated it as for the last, oh, let's say 100 years. And what I mean when I say that is that science may in fact not be a signal detection problem. When I'm sort of taking this idea from a talk and now a paper by John Wickstead, professor at UC San Diego, who approaches this idea in the following way. We as psychologists and many scientists do our research and then conduct statistics on our results in order to find pretty much one number, and that number is P. We seek a p-value. And we want that p-value to be under a threshold. If the p-value is under that threshold, hooray, we have a significant finding. We have evidence that our means differ, or whatever other statistical test we're running, evidence that our variables correlate. If we have a p larger than our threshold, then, oh boo, we don't have a significant finding. We can't say that we have evidence that these two things differ, that our groups differ, that our groups are correlated, whatever your test may be. Now, the utility of doing this is that it gives us a really sharp distinction of answers to our questions. Is group A different from group B? If you have a p lower than 0.05, yes. If you have a p larger than 0.05, no. Great. Solid, simple decision-making metric. The problem with that is that the true situation, maybe even the truth of what we're interested in, isn't really whether those two groups differ, but how much they differ. We're not curious to know if the mean from one is different from the mean of the other. We used to be, arguably, we originally designed our statistics to test this, but the way psychology has moved forward, and in fact many sciences have moved forward, suggests that what we'd rather know is exactly how different those two means might be. That leaves the researcher with the ability to judge whether that difference is interesting or not. And so we can make those judgments on more of a case-by-case basis and thus arrive at science in a possibly slightly more subjective way, but in a way that is far more accurate, according to Wickstead. He says that rather than seeking P, rather than making a binary yes or no decision about every single piece of science we do, what we should be doing is trying to accurately estimate effect size. I have it on the slide here as D, thinking of Cohen's D, but any other measure of effect size works in essentially the same way. We want to know how different our means are, and so we measure effect size rather than measuring P. This is, I'll say again, very convincing to me. It's something that I hope to use more consistently moving forward. So I've pulled together an example to try to illustrate this idea. If you go to the next slide, you'll see the results from a sort of play study run by the folks at 538.com. What they did was, in order to show that you can get a lot of spurious correlations and very low p-values by using large data sets with lots and lots of covariates, they found relationships in what they jokingly called a shocking new study between likelihood of eating egg rolls and dog ownership, or likelihood of drinking coffee and cat ownership, likelihood of eating steak with fat trimmed off, and lack of belief in a god. Things that, you know, we would pretty safely say in our everyday lives are probably not related to one another. But if you have lots and lots of data and you put everything into one big function and look at hundreds, or even if you look at tens, but in this case, they looked at thousands of possible relationships, you're going to find some stuff. And you might have really high p-values. But if you then went a step further and looked into the effect sizes for these relationships, I would argue that you would see them for what they are, very tiny effects that just turn out to be significant because of the huge amount of data you have, the overpowering of the study. On to slide 5, you'll see a slightly differently run example that 538 put together to do with diet research. Now here, rather than showing you p-values, they're actually showing you something that is a lot more like effect size. So this is an effect estimate that centers around 1, so 1 here means that the effect is neutral, and if the effect goes between 1 and 0, we have a negative effect of this item, lowering risk for cancer, and if we have an effect between 1 and, I believe 1 and a theoretically ever-expanding metric, but here they top it off at 10, we conclude that that increases risk. And so when you look at an estimate like this, you get a lot better information about how significant something might be in a more typical descriptor type usage of the word significant. We're not looking at p-values anymore. We're looking at the body of evidence as a whole. So this does a couple of good things better than that previous table did. It shows you many studies at once, but it also gives you the estimate of the size of the effect in each of those studies. And I would argue gives us a lot better information about the size of the relationships between eating these foods and the likelihood that they increase or lower your risk of cancer, or neither. So skipping into today's ideas, this is going to be a slightly different topic than that of the difference between p-values and effect sizes. But we'll sort of jump right in here. I want you to think about a couple of different cases of things you've learned and things you've maybe heard about in the news in the past 10 years or so. First question I have for you, is the HPV vaccine life-threatening? You may have an opinion on this already. This was quite a big news story in Canada in 2009. A 14-year-old girl named Natalie Morton died hours after getting her vaccine. The autopsy after revealed a malignant tumor in her heart and lungs. But despite the fact that this tumor existed, the sort of main news story was that she got her vaccine and then died hours later. And so it's critical in these kinds of moments to think about the true real-world odds of two events co-occurring. And this is something I want to encourage you to think about in general. It would be a very weird world indeed in which no child who recently received a vaccine could possibly die. That would mean that a vaccine made you immune to death for a couple hours, and we know that's not the case. So if two events are independent, then they might sometimes co-occur. In fact, they could be likely to sometimes co-occur, especially over the general swath of all of humanity. Eventually, we will see things co-occur. And with probability working the way it does, we eventually will. And that probability is going to be the product of the individual probabilities. So if every single child gets this vaccine, then the probability that one will get the vaccine and then die shortly thereafter would actually be quite high. Let me ask you another question. How about the MMR vaccine? Does that cause autism? The idea that it does came from a study published by Andrew Wakefield, who had a sample of 12 children in the UK who were diagnosed with developmental delays, 8 of those kids diagnosed with autism. They all received their diagnoses, though, after getting their measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. And so, again, if we apply those same rules of probability, you can think about how most kids get the MMR vaccine. And at the time of the study, in fact, 90% of kids in the UK got that vaccine around 1 or 2 years of age, which also happens to be the exact age range at which developmental delays are typically starting to be diagnosed. Most kids who have developmental delays don't show them in the first year of life. You can't really diagnose anything like that until a child is later in their second year or even moving into their third. So almost all children diagnosed with developmental delays probably have had an MMR vaccine, even though it has no real-world causal influence on developmental delays. Here's another question for you. Does red wine promote heart health? There's lots of good research going on here. Many studies have observed that individuals who have a couple drinks of alcohol per week have lower rates of heart disease, lower rates of other diseases than people who don't. But again, I encourage you to think about the base rates. Why might this be the case? What other possible situation could there be in our world such that people who drink a little bit of red wine every week have healthier hearts? Well, one reason could be that especially in North America and Europe, a substantial number of people who don't drink alcohol avoid it because they're alcoholics in recovery. And another large group of people who don't drink alcohol do so because of a pre-existing medical condition that makes it very dangerous for them to drink. And so if you take that into account and you compare the rate of certain diseases with people who, for people who do drink wine every now and then, to people who to rates of diseases for people who never drink wine, you have a confound there. You have a variable you need to deal with. The fact that a lot of the people who don't drink wine probably can't due to the presence of some disease. So these kinds of things are really well accounted for in the work of excellent researchers for different topics dealing with addiction. One in particular is a former colleague of mine, Tim Stockwell, who works at the Center for Addiction Research in British Columbia at the University of Victoria, where I did my graduate work. Didn't meet him personally, but worked nearby. Here's another interesting display of research out in the regular world. Does praying together promote staying together? This was an article in the Globe and Mail, which I believe is more or less the USA Today kind of paper of Canada. It's a national newspaper. They put out an article that said exactly this: couples who pray together stay together. And the implication of a title like that is that prayer has a causal effect on relationship stability. And that could, of course, be true, but there are a variety of other plausible interpretations of this correlation, and you can probably think of some right now. One might be that people who pray together have a stronger relationship with their religion, and it is usually true that religions tend to discourage separation of marriages. And so it could just be the case that more religious people are also less likely to divorce, and they're more likely to pray together. Could likewise be the case that religion is something that really strengthens a relationship. People who have one very strong thing in common, like their religion and their strong belief in it, are going to be very likely to pray together and probably very likely to stay together because they have these important features of themselves in common. Another question for you, commonly discussed in the media. Do vitamin D supplements reduce cancer risk? There is a real correlation here. People who take or people who have higher rates of vitamin D tend to have lower rates of cancer and vice versa. But it's not really clear in the literature whether having higher vitamin D prevents cancer or being vulnerable to cancer lowers vitamin D. There's been randomized, prospective, double-blind, placebo-controlled experiments that haven't really strongly supported the idea that vitamin D supplements lower cancer risk. It does seem like there are not many adverse effects to have taking vitamin D, and it's cheap, but it doesn't really seem like it'll lower. It won't hurt you. Not really sure that it'll do much either. So what we're dealing with when we read about scientific findings in the media, when we're told about them by friends, when you're told colloquially about them like I did some of the ones just now, the central question we're asking ourselves is how we're going to decide how much confidence you should have in a claim that one variable has a causal influence on another variable. How do you decide whether X influences Y? One way we do this is with intuition, sort of casual observation. Do I think that makes sense? Does that argument hold water for me? Does the logic seem to follow? Does it feel true in my gut? Some of that kind of Stephen Colbert truthiness feeling. This is legitimate. It is a good way to have an initial assessment of whether you think one variable might influence another. Another thing you can do is think about where you got the information. So if you get the information from an authority source, a source that you trust, let's say when you're a kid, that source is pretty much always your parent, right? Whenever your parent tells you something, you believe them. When you go to school, whenever your teacher tells you something, you tend to believe them. When you come to class, hopefully I tell you things that you, as an authority figure, that you think are worth believing. And there's lots of other examples of this. Certain newspapers you trust, others you might not so much, and so on. Another way that we can decide how much confidence to have in these kinds of claims is by assessing the science itself. Science in general is a slightly different way of knowing than all these others, and the reason it is that it's this combination of logic and mathematics and rigorous empirical observation that enables us to come to conclusions in a slightly different way. It enables us to turn observation into dependable statements about the world around us. And so if you're seeing claims made about science in popular media, my advice is to go to the sources of those sciences. See if you can figure out what study they're trying to talk about. And one really easy giveaway is if someone tries to claim to you that they have some piece of information that they gathered from a study and they can't tell you the origin of that study, it would become dubious to me. I would want to know why they can't tell me the origin. Tell me where the data came from. Where are you getting your information? And if you can find it, you could often go to the library, probably the university library. You could use a resource like the Web of Science or Google Scholar, and these things can lead you to the original study. But even then, when you get past, let's say, your local news affiliate's tweet into their website, and then all the way down to the National Academy of Sciences, or to an Elsevier page, or what have you, and you're actually looking at a study now, you're looking at, like, let's even say, a PDF published in a peer-reviewed journal, you run into yet another problem, and it is that some science is a little more rigorous than other science. And you've probably heard of some of these findings lately when looking into what's going on in psychology. So a lot of this reporting started happening around the middle of the 2010s. The problem really came to a head for psychologists around 2011. But starting in like 2015, 2016, you started to see articles in places like The Atlantic. Psychology is in a replication crisis, and it can't be wished away. Psychology then, according to Wired a little later, was in crisis over whether it is in crisis. There's a Wikipedia entry for the replication crisis, so you know it's legit. Articles from Science Magazine in 2016. There's a chapter on NOBA, the free online introductory psych textbook on the replication crisis in psychology. Harvard has blogged about it on their forward-facing website. a really trusted science writer named Dan Engber asked in Slate, is science broken, in summer 2017? And then Jesse Singel, another great science writer, asked if the replication crisis is overblown. And Christia Schwanden responded, science isn't broken, in 538. And then further from there, we're all p-hacking now. And there's episodes of podcasts. There's one I've linked to here, an episode of the NPR Money podcast. There's episodes of Hidden Brain. There's an episode of John Oliver's show in which everyone is talking about this replication crisis. So I wanted to give you a couple tools using the examples we just went through that can help you decide whether you think any individual study may or may not be replicable, meaning that it might or might not be reliable, that you could run a study using all the same variables as the original and come to the same finding. So let's go back and assess whether each of those findings I presented are likely to be victims of the replication crisis. So let's first think about how many of those studies use large representative samples. I talked about the HPV vaccine, the MMR vaccine, red wine, praying, and vitamin D. Which of those use large representative samples in their studies? If you're having trouble answering this question for yourself, that's because you don't really know. I made it clear that one was a single case, the story of Natalie Morton. I told you that the Wakefield study had a small N, and by the way, that study has long since been retracted, and it was originally the only empirical evidence in favor of any linkage between autism and the MMR vaccine. So all that hysteria is based in essentially no scientific findings at this point. Wakefield has long since admitted that he cherry-picked and faked data and all kinds of bad things. But I didn't say anything about any of those other studies. I told you nothing about how many people, how many studies, the representativeness of the samples. So when you hear about any study you care about, when you hear about a science finding that you think is interesting and valuable, you should ask about the sample. How many people were in that study? Who were the people? Well, it was, 10 Caucasian undergraduates in Portland, Oregon. Okay, does that matter for me? Am I anything like those people? Always worth asking. Was it 100 people from a diverse set of places? Great. A diverse set of backgrounds? Better. So two questions there. How large was the sample, and how representative was that sample? And so how widely can we apply its conclusions? Because many claims, it turns out, are based on single cases or small or non-representative samples. And because, as we've already discussed, chance plays a huge role in life, completely weird, totally atypical, very unlikely seeming things actually happen quite a lot. Further complicating this issue is the lack of information we get from a single study with only, let's say, 20 people in it in psychology. Dr. Nick Brown once observed that when physicists are collecting data at, say, a particle accelerator, a place like the Large Hadron Collider, they collect more than a billion bytes of data per second, and they collect those data for months or even years before they arrive at any conclusion about the behavior of particles. And so let's compare that to a psychology study. Let's say you collected data from 80 undergraduate subjects, a pretty good sample size. They answered all the items in a 20-item psychological scale between 1 and 5. Pretty good information from each of those people. You can compress all that information into less than 500 bytes. Compare that to the billions and billions of bytes that physicists are collecting. So we have, in psychology, a tougher problem to deal with. We need to think especially hard about how we are making conclusions from our data and how we are talking about those conclusions, especially outside the academy. So here's another question. How many of the studies I mentioned earlier were published in peer-reviewed, refereed journal articles? So This is getting at that authority part. And the answer, pretty much yet again, is that you don't really know. I told you I got one from the Globe and Mail. I told you that Wakefield was published somewhere, and again, since retracted. But you really don't know. I didn't cite the original sources, which happens quite frequently in popular media. So anytime you can't figure out what the source is, treat that citation of that source with skepticism until the user of it can direct you to the original source. How about this? How many of those studies, or of the findings rather, that I proposed earlier, were based on more than one study? Again, you don't really know. A lot of the things I showed you are just one-off studies. The couples who pray together, stay together thing, one study. The red wine heart health thing has a lot of work behind it. Of course, the two vaccines were based on single studies. So anytime you hear about a finding that you think is interesting, that you think is important, also ask if it has been replicated. Has a different group of people found the same thing in a different place? And so in general, I want you to come away with the idea that more often than not, none of these important pieces of information are published in popular media articles that are representing science. So think carefully about them. Try to find the original sources if you care to and if you can. You can usually pull out the sort of big four goals of summarizing any study. You can figure out what the goal of the study was, the method of the study, the results, and the conclusions. Maybe not so specifically every time, but you usually can get those four pieces. But you can't dig deeply enough into the methodology to learn whether that study should be trusted. So keep these items in mind whenever you hear that your phone activates the love center in your brain, for example. That was the news story I loved a couple years ago. So put more stock in studies that have been replicated, studies in which the same procedures obtain the same relationships across two time points or across two locations or with independent researchers or with totally different samples. Put more stock in studies reported in refereed journals, partially because researchers go through quite a lot of work to make sure that their work is publishable there. They'll submit the manuscript to the editor of a journal, who will send it out to usually about four independent experts, usually three or four. And then those experts will either reject the paper or most of the time request improvements. It is very rare for a researcher to send out a paper and to hear back, hey, it looks great as it is, we're going to publish this. Most of the time, the independent experts will, at the very least, require some kinds of improvements to the paper itself, if not to future data collection and the science itself. And then very, very often, it's just flat out rejected. So only the best of the best, hopefully, makes it into these journals. The article is then only published if the editor and the reviewers agree that it meets the criteria for publication. But again, that's not always a perfect system. Even good journals can publish weak science from time to time. The journal's H factor is not indicative of how high quality all of its publications are. It's important to assess each piece by itself. In fact, there are some new data published in Nature, linked to in slide 22, that suggests that past performance in science is not predictive of future performance, and so the H index of a particular researcher might not be as informative of the quality of their science as we thought it was, probably because most people really only make one major discovery in a lifetime. It's a rare scientist who makes many huge, important discoveries. And so to try to insert a career trajectory into a kind of pre-designated pattern is what some of the H-index kind of math attempts to do, and that probably doesn't really fit typical human career paths. So back to the point here, watching for all these things will enable you to better detect some of the surprisingly typical research practices that have led psychologists and other researchers astray for the last 50 years or so. And so you as a reader can watch watch for them as you read, and you as a researcher can safeguard against them. People have gotten into habits of doing various other things, like selectively reporting different dependent variables, measuring three or four and only reporting one can skew your findings. Some people have been in the habit of exercising what we call optional stopping. That means you collect some data, you run a statistical test, and if the direction of the difference is in the direction you thought it would be, but the test is not yet significant, you don't yet have that p-value of less than 0.05, then maybe you just collect data from 10 more people, test it again. And if it's still not there, collect from 10 more, test it again. This process will eventually yield you a significant result, but it will be falsely inflated. There's, of course, also this issue we call the file drawer effect. Lots of people run many, many studies and find nothing, and journals aren't really interested in publishing those studies. If your paper doesn't have a significant p-value, it could be really tough to get that kind of thing published. Now, that's the truth of that statement is reducing lately, and thankfully, but it used to be quite challenging to get anything other than significant and potentially groundbreaking and interesting findings published, especially in the bigger journals, within psychology at least. And so if you run many studies and find nothing, and then run one more and find something, and you only report the last one, that is, it's going to give readers of journals false impressions about how easy it was to get that one finding. Other people were in the practice of adding other independent variables later, moving things in and out. Hey, let me see if I just look at a gender split, see if I can get something significant here. All these things, by the way, seemed very innocuous at the time. It was typical practice. No one thought it was bad. And we've since started to realize how those kind of things can lead to findings like Daryl Bem's 2011 paper on in which he found the existence of extrasensory perception. People also do things like interpreting against the data just to support their theories. And then, of course, it's also possible that some people are out there committing outright fraud. There was a big story a few years ago, around 2011, a psychologist named Diederik Stapel, in the Netherlands, had essentially made up data in several dozen published papers, many published in respectable journals, lots reported in public popular media because they were on fun, interesting topics, and his work has been since all retracted. And so there's certainly some people doing this out in the world of psychology and other sciences as well, but this is quite rare. We're mostly focused on people who are unintentionally used to be unintentionally doing things that maybe push us around a little bit in our statistics and lead us to more false positives than we originally hoped for. So to wrap this all up, science is still worthwhile. I don't want you to decide that psychology and statistics is a useless way to move forward. Good science is still a very strong way to test hypotheses. But it remains true that bad science is not. And I heard a great quote from James Heathers. Science is supposed to be self-correcting, but we had sort of just been going along and assuming that it would correct itself. And what Heathers said is, well, yeah, but it's only self-correcting if we correct it. And that's what I think psychology has been doing as we've been moving through this replication crisis and hopefully now credibility revolution. Because it's true that a lot of psychology has used kind of mediocre science over the last few decades. So when you hear of a surprising finding, be skeptical, especially if you find out that it was only obtained in a single study with a small sample. All this put together, I think, will enable you to enact the quote of one last psychologist, whose photo is on slide 25 here and who created a lot of the material for this presentation. So thanks to Steve Lindsay. I hope that you now feel that you have some of the skills to tell shit from Shinola when it truly matters. I'm, of course, not the only person to ever talk about this. I've got an example of science journalism for you to assess linked on the final slide here to think about whether you make a decision. Do you think this is good science journalism? Do you think it represents the findings well or not? There's a great lecture on this topic, linked to on the final slide, and then another one that is a sort of extension of some of these ideas, gives you lots more thoughts on the replication crisis. I recommend both of those videos, done by excellent people, and saying a lot of the same things I've said here, but in different ways, and then expanding upon certain points. So I hope you've enjoyed. Have a good rest of your week. Thanks for listening.